Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take for adults to recall the facts of their own childhoods, and how are we changed by the discovery that our parents' lives were more complicated than we ever imagined at the time? As a hearing child born to deaf parents, Cambry Cruz understood her home life was different from that of her schoolmates. From an early age, she helped interpret for her parents and grandparents in the hearing world and was never shushed by the adults in her life. Her father was charming and handsome, her mother lively and popular in the deaf community, and although Cruz was aware they struggled financially, she could not have imagined the chaotic nature of their relationship. Today, Cambry Cruz owns a PR and production company that specializes in comedy. She shares her story in her new memoir, Burn Down the Ground. Cambry, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris. It's a pleasure.
You open the book with a scene of your visit to your father on Christmas Day. You haven't seen him in years. He's in prison in Huntsville, and he's asked you to sneak something into him.
Well, he actually asked me to sneak in several things to him. I only honored one of his requests. He asked for a jumbo pack of Wrigley's Juicy Fruit gum, his favorite gum. And he'd been in prison for a couple of years at this point, and I hadn't seen him in almost 10. So I thought gum seemed harmless enough, and I wanted to give him something special and mark the visit and give him something to look forward to. So I had a jumbo pack of Wrigley's Juicy Fruit in the waistband of my pants. Not the wisest thing I've ever done in my life, but...
Well, what's so great about the scene that you chose there is that although we don't learn until the end of the book why he's there, we get this sense that even while incarcerated, he has this sort of cockiness and this sense that the rules do not or should not apply to him.
Oh, absolutely. He grew up in a residential school for the deaf, and they regimented his life down to the minute, what time he woke up, what time he went to bed, when his classes were, when he was able to get away from school on field trips, every part of his life from the age of 5 years old until he graduated high school around 19 years old. Mm-hmm. So he hated rules and ironically thought that it was like a prison to him. The school was like a prison. And so when he finally got into the quote-unquote free world outside of school, he was determined to not live by anyone's rules, just to be as impulsive and free-spirited as he chose. And as a kid, that was pretty awesome to have this really gregarious, fun-loving dad who was prone to pulling pranks and just life was flying by the seat of his pants and would do some really reckless things, too, but it was fun to watch at a distance, for sure.
When he took you to register for high school, he said, here, you fill out your mom's name on this form so you can write your own excuse notes.
Yeah, I didn't even quite register what he was asking me to do. I'm like, no, I can't do this. It needs to be one of my parents' signatures. This is to get me out of school, and that way they can compare to make sure that the signatures match up on any school notes. And he goes, yeah, I know. He totally understood. He was like, yeah, that way you can fill it out for yourself and you can skip school anytime you want. I was like, oh, I never even took advantage of it. Maybe once, but I was a good kid.
The next scene in the book takes us to this bowling tournament organized for members of the deaf community. And it's a great illustration, I think, of the liveliness of deaf culture in America. Will you talk for a few minutes about the distinction between small d deaf and capital D deaf?
Small d for deaf means basically just the inability to hear, whereas capital D for deaf is the culture, the cultural identity. There are schools for the deaf. There's their own separate language. They have their own theater and performing arts functions. They have their own tournaments for sports. They have their own universities. So there is a complete culture, almost like a distinct race. It's not quite as far, but almost. That defines somebody who's involved in that community.
And there's a really fascinating difference between your parents in terms of how they accepted themselves within that community. I mean, your mother
absolutely.
Was born into it, but your father really didn't look at this as a blessing to have been born into this culture.
No, absolutely not. And I do think that that's one of the defining points in his life that has landed him in prison. My mother was born to two deaf parents. Her sister was deaf. Her aunts and uncles, they're all deaf. So she was born into a family that identified strongly in deaf culture. She immediately had a language, American Sign Language, ASL, and a cultural identity. She had a place where she belonged fully. My father, on the other hand, was born into a hearing family. They had little to no knowledge of sign language at the time. They all do now, or many of them do, but at the time they didn't. And he lived in a very, very small rural town in Oklahoma. So he was isolated with little to no language, and he didn't even identify with his own family. And then, of course, he was sent off to residential school for the deaf, so he didn't even live with them for most of his life, of his childhood. So it definitely affected his self-esteem, and he did not like being deaf, whereas my mother considered it a blessing. Like, if I had deaf babies, her grandchildren, she would be over the moon excited about that.
It's so interesting. There's a scene in the book where you write about your paternal grandfather, who was very kind to you, which is in stark contrast of your father's memories of him. And I'm curious, as a memoirist, where you stand on this question of which matters more, objective truth or the truth as we perceive it as individuals?
Well, the truth for my father is that his father was abusive to him. And whether he was or not, I have no evidence of it. I just know that my father was scarred by it. And I do believe that he probably was abusive. I know that they used cherry switches from branches from a cherry tree and a belt. But the grandfather that I knew and loved would never have hurt me in that way. And so that was my truth as well. And it is quite possible for them to be one and the same person, as I've discovered with my own father, that my father was my hero. And he also is somebody who deserves very much to be in jail.
Yeah, we come to really like your dad and your mom as well, and see him through your eyes as a child. You know, maybe inconsistent at times, but, you know, charming. And is it hard for your friends who know the whole story to understand why it is so important to you today to have some kind of a relationship with him?
I am sometimes asked, yes, why do you still talk to him? And the main reason is because he is in jail. I don't know that I would be able to have a relationship with him outside of prison. In jail, he's sober. He's in one place, and he's not really doing harm to anyone. For the most part, he has gotten into fights and has struck a guard before. But for the most part, he does stay out of trouble now. And so for that, and because he's able to... He, as much as he hates rules, he really needs them, and he almost thrives in jail. But I think at the end of the day, people realize that he's my father, and that's a love that you and a bond that you can't really break. So I think people understand that.
Your mom is a fascinating character throughout the book. On the one hand, she's this pot-smoking party girl who marries the bad boy, and on the other hand, she's a woman who pretty much never misses submitting her church tithes.
Well, she definitely had a conflicting relationship with church and with my father. At the heart of who my mother is, she is a good woman and a good person, but she was definitely influenced by my father's wild, bad ways, pot smoking being the worst of it for her. But she was badly influenced by him, but also she was in an abusive relationship, which carries with it its own issues.
Reading your story as a CODA, which is an acronym for Children of Deaf Adults, with hearing, it reminded me so much of other stories I've read by first-generation American children of immigrant parents.
Yes, very much.
You have one foot in each culture, but you're just a little bit outside of each one at the same time.
Right. I'm so glad you mentioned that, because people always remark on how exotic they just... Deafness and deaf culture and sign language seems so exotic and so special, and this visual, beautiful language, and it just seems so foreign. But it is very much just like if, as you mentioned, an immigrant family where they're a first generation and English is the second language being spoken in the home, and you're forced to interpret. For me, my mother can talk. And she can hear a little bit with two hearing aids, very, very powerful hearing aids. But her parents were completely deaf. And when I'd spend summers with them, I was definitely my grandmother's little right-hand man, little assistant. And it forces you to grow up. You're definitely exposed to things as a child that you shouldn't really know, doctor's appointments and banking and large, big terms and, you know, foreclosures, which we faced, and my grandmother's smoking habit was affecting her health. And so I was negotiating things with doctors and trying to explain things to her. Hmm. So, yeah, you definitely learn things at a much younger age.
Yeah, you write about being, I guess, 3 or 4 and your grandparents take you to the ice cream store. And you said you spoke to the person behind the counter and said, well, my grandfather wants brown and my grandmother wants white.
That
you
was
didn't
actually
know the
my
words.
Mom.
Oh, your
yeah,
mom did that.
Yeah,
okay.
But she was so young. She was about 3 years old and she didn't know the words for chocolate and vanilla. She knew the signs brown and white.
Hmm.
And that's just so, I think that's so cute. But at the end of the day, it's like, oh, bless her little heart. She had to take charge. And it does put you in a very interesting power of authority over people who should have authority over you.
Yeah.
You're in this very, you're in a power position.
And your mom, I guess, having some hearing and pretty clear speech, had a lot of advantages, or we would look at them as advantages from the hearing world,
correct,
as compared with her peers.
Yes, she definitely did. And it was, I'm sure it affected my parents' marriage because of my father's esteem issues with mm-hmm. being deaf. She got to enjoy music, which I know he loves. He loves Elvis and is a little obsessed with him. And he's never gotten to hear a single note of music in his life. So I know that frustrated him. And he didn't want us to have a radio in the car because it didn't seem fair that we all got to have radio and he didn't. And she went to movies with us and just engaged in things with us as children that bonded us and that he was always kind of left out on.
So that it makes sense that in cities, deaf communities come together because they are, you know, suddenly you're welcomed into a group of people who can understand everything you want to say. You didn't really have that close by when you guys moved out to the country.
And that also is another kind of major plot point in my father's life
yeah.
that I can point to and say, okay, when he was a child, he was he endured corporal punishment. Then he was also not in a deaf cultural family, so he didn't identify there, so he had self-esteem issues. Then he's abandoned at a deaf school. And so you can point to these little roadmaps in my father's life. And one of the things that he has always struggled with was just not being able to enjoy the same things as everyone else. And in the deaf community, they have clubs and social engagements. And when we moved to the country, we were in the middle of nowhere. And so we were now as isolated as a family could be. And so it took him away from everything.
It is hard to imagine raising a child and trying to discipline that child when you cannot communicate with them in words. I mean, it sounds like torture for everybody involved.
Well, you do have words. You know, it's a different language, that's all. And, you know, you have the same issues with parental, where you kind of butt up against your parents.
Well, I mean, your father's parents who did not at the time, am I correct, speak
yes.
sign language?
Yeah, I understand. Yeah, and I'm sure that lent to a lot of frustration and misunderstandings. And then my father was just a little bit of a prankster and mm-hmm. and a wild child. And it's almost like whenever you hear about Helen Keller when she was a child and how she would throw those tantrums,
yeah.
it was all stemming from just extraordinary frustration.
My guest is author Cambry Cruz. Today she owns a PR and production company and is also author of the memoir Burn Down the Ground. We'll resume our conversation with her in a moment. If you'd like to join us, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Cambry Cruz. Her new memoir is called Burn Down the Ground. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, as you mentioned, it would have been rough on your father in particular, but your mother as well, to sort of move out to the country. But part of the reason they were there was because your father had been messing around.
Oh, yeah. My father was never faithful to my mother. It's not something I knew as a child, but that it definitely was the biggest factor in our decision to move into the middle of nowhere in Montgomery, Texas. And it makes sense a little bit. It's like, you know what, let's just start over and start from scratch, which is part of what the title means, Burn Down the Ground. We moved into the middle of nowhere where it was just completely overgrown with brush and jungle, and the agricultural term is slash and burn. But we burned down the ground, and the ash fertilizes the soil, and it allows the grass to grow back, and it also, for us, cleared the snakes. It was just snake infested, so it served a dual purpose for us.
And when you got to school, that you were about 7 or 8 at the time, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When you got to school, it's really interesting because I think people might assume that you would be isolated because your family was different. But in fact, there was that fascination with deaf culture and you were sort of enjoyed being different.
Oh, yeah. It put us in my older brother and I, it put us on this weird pedestal because the kids out in the woods, they were just as bored and isolated as we were. And so, yeah, we were kind of like almost museum artifacts. What? Your parents are deaf? What does that mean? And so we were kind of treated a little differently in a good way, where I was sent around from class to class and I taught the kids the alphabet and ASL. And then a couple of years later, I would do it again in gym class and teach everyone all over again. So it definitely set us apart. But also the deaf community is very much a storytelling community. Mm-hmm. It's not a written language. And so when you're at a deaf club, my father in particular would hold court and tell stories and try to make people laugh. And I think that was just kind of passed down to my brother and I, where we would make funny accents and voices and tell stories and jokes. And it was just part of who we were. I don't know if that's a nature or a nurture thing, but it was definitely in our blood.
Well, it makes sense that it would be, in many ways, a serendipitous background for someone who would go on to work in the performing arts.
Yeah, and it certainly helped in developing the book. I would tell stories on stage, and as a high schooler, I participated in UIL, the one-act play competition, so it definitely carried over into my choices in life, for my career.
You do tell a funny story about trying out for The Diary of Anne Frank and using a lot of enthusiasm. Can you tell us about that?
Well, my mother had, I was only about 9 at the time of this audition, and my mom didn't tell me what I was auditioning for, and even if she had, I don't know if I would have known what The Diary of Anne Frank was. Mm-hmm. But part of sign language is you use your whole body to tell a story. You use your facial expressions to invoke meaning and tone and all that. And I, as a child of deaf adults, but also immersed in the deaf community with my grandparents, aunts, and uncles and everything, I fully engaged in conversations. And I never really dropped that trait whenever I would just talk with hearing people. Mm-hmm. and I talked really loud, and everything in our house was very loud. So during this audition, I just screamed because my mom told me, you know, make sure you project and enunciate and everything. So I was screaming the lines, and which, you know, Anne Frank was probably trying to stay as quiet as me. She white hair. I was just a towhead. I don't know what my mom was thinking taking me to this audition, but she was not daunted by it. She was like, oh, you have to go on thousands of auditions sometimes before you get a part.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Jane in Dallas. Hey, Jane.
Hi. Good afternoon. I am a blind parent of 2 full-grown children. And so I can totally relate to kind of the opposite end of your story. I was just curious. I know that for my children, especially my daughter, who is now 35 and a photographer, and I think she developed her eye because she was my eyes, and she even admitted this to me recently, but I know that there are times that she'll just say, I'm just tired of describing where we are or what things look like. And I know that she gets worn out, and we have to work with that. You know, we have to, that's just part of the relationship. And sometimes it brings us closer, and sometimes it just hurts. And I was wondering, for you being an adult child of two deaf parents, did you ever get tired, or how do you deal with those times when you were the interpreter and the go-between?
Right. Well, I definitely took advantage of my parents' deafness at times. There are the upsides. The downsides are definitely that I did not cherish the role as interpreter whenever it was for something complicated and beyond my educational years. For instance, I had to book airline flights for myself one time, and I was just mortified. I didn't understand what was being asked of me about layovers and transfers, and I would definitely get frustrated and just hot. My whole body would just get hot all over. My brother, on the other hand, actually loved it. He loved being in charge. He liked how smart he came across. He liked one-upping me, too. There's that sibling rivalry, of course. And interestingly, he actually now is an interpreter for the deaf, which actually is true of a lot of CODA kids and as adults when they grow up. But there was a time in my life where I did reject the whole deaf community. After I'd gotten married and moved away from Texas, I didn't want any part of it for a bit. And I think it's because I'd been an interpreter my whole life, and I just wanted a break. But now, of course, I'm back in it, and I love it, and I love how it sets me apart, and I cherish the memories that I have of it. But, yeah, there are conflicts, for sure.
Is there any sense from those within the deaf community that they accept you based on your family history, but you are still not entirely one of them?
I think if you're raised CODA in deaf culture, you are considered part. You are deaf with a capital D.
Yeah.
One of the problems my father has with the interpreter at prison is she's not a CODA. Mm. And it's something that really burns his hide. Because you don't quite fully understand. And I suppose after you've been an interpreter for many years, you come to learn this and you do become accepted. But she's a very young girl, this interpreter. She's in her early 20s. And I think that just bothers my father to no end.
Well, it makes sense in a way. It's almost like sitting in this country and learning Chinese really well, but not having traveled there.
Right.
Or lived there.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. You'll come to understand things, but you'll never 100% be part of it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phones to Heidi in Fort Worth. Hi, Heidi.
Hi. My question, I know a tiny bit of sign language. I have some deaf people in my family, too, and I sometimes substitute for a deaf inclusion school because I know a little bit of sign language, and I have noticed that the kids who come from families where the parents either were deaf or learned sign language when they had a deaf baby seem to do a lot better when they enter kindergarten than the
Absolutely.
Children who come without that. But yet audiologists are still telling parents they will never learn to speak if you teach them sign. And I was wondering, since you have a parent who grew up in both environments, I was wondering what your opinion was on all of that.
Yeah, it is a very controversial point in the deaf community, and I have never fully understood why would you take away the first natural language of a child, which is sign language of a deaf child. I understand that it might help the oral version of learning how to speak. It maybe makes them learn the oral version a lot faster, but it does take away the natural instinct to want to speak in sign language. I've never quite understood why it has to be so one or the other. I think a blending makes more sense. If I were to have a deaf baby, my mother, of course, as I mentioned, would be excited, but I would still have a cochlear implant, but I would also make sure that they learned sign language and were immersed in deaf culture. That's part of who we are.
Your first word in sign language in ASL was at 5 months old.
6 months old.
Six months old.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Daddy, of course.
And then Mama came soon after.
Soon after. Mm-hmm. And by the time I was 18 months old, I was fully, I was speaking in complete sentences and signing songs. Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star was my favorite, apparently. My mom loves to tell that story about I got into an accident and hit my head, and I had to get rushed to the hospital. And the doctors and nurses all came out. I had a crowd around me. And they could not believe I was only 18 months old, and because I had told them the whole story in spoken English mm-hmm. and then also signed them all the songs that I was planning to do before I hit my head.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest this hour is Cambry Cruz. Her new memoir is called Burn Down the Ground. We have an email here from David in North Richland Hills, a town I know you know quite well.
Yeah.
David says, I just finished your book and thought it was amazing. What are your expectations for when your father is eventually released from prison?
It's something that we're actually, my mom and I and my brother are all talking about right now, actually, because he's up for parole for the first time this June. In Texas, you have to serve half your sentence before you're eligible, and he was sentenced to 20 years, so this June marks his 10-year anniversary. My father has high hopes, and I don't know if it's because he's in prison that he's hope is all you really have. So he plans on moving to New York, possibly falling in love with the city and staying, or just staying here for a short time and then moving to the country where it's cheaper. Mm-hmm. And I kind of don't want to spoil his dreams, but at the same time, I don't think he's ready. Mm-hmm. He's never dealt with his anger issues. He has never gone through drug or alcohol counseling. And prison has isolated him and made him angrier and angrier, and he still expresses anger during every visit that I have with him. And in letters sometimes he talks about how he wants to get even with certain people when he gets out. And so I just can't imagine how we would deal with them on the outside in the free world. If he is released, I would like to support him as much as I can the way I have while he's in jail, which is just nominal financial support mm-hmm. and doing research for him and helping him navigate the legal system and writing letters for him, you know, translating his letters. He writes in ASL, which is not a written language, but he writes the way he would speak in ASL.
Yeah.
So I help him translate them into written English. And I would continue to help him do that. But would I want him living with me? No, absolutely mm-hmm. not. And I think we have the relationship that we do now because he is in prison.
I mean, this is in so many ways sort of a useless question, but have you ever allowed yourself to speculate what his life would have been like had he has a twin brother who does hear.
Right.
If your father had been born with hearing, do you imagine what his life would be like?
Yeah, especially when he was first sentenced. I grieved the way you would grieve if somebody had been killed
yeah.
suddenly. And it was a very awful year or two of grappling with the fact that my father was going to spend at least 20 years in prison probably and possibly die in prison. He's not a young man, but and so of course during that grieving process it was like the what ifs and the whys. Why did he turn out the way he did? And through writing the book and uncovering all these milestones in his life that I'd pointed to earlier, where I can really point to these things and say, oh, yeah, this is when this happened. This is when he started getting angry. This is when the drinking became a problem. And it's hard not to say, gosh, what if we had done things differently? But that's part of why I wrote the book, so that we can learn from it, so that we don't let history repeat itself.
Working through some of this material on stage as a performer before you put it down in the form of a memoir, what did you learn about the story and how you wanted to tell it that you might not have discovered in the same way had you simply been at your computer the whole time?
Well, telling the story out loud, Judy Blume actually recommends this on her website. She has tips for writers, mm-hmm. and she talks about how you should say your work out loud, read it aloud. I didn't get this tip until after the book had already been accepted. I was like, oh, shucks, I wish I had learned this sooner. But I had naturally done it in the storytelling community. And it helped me find where the funny parts were, mm-hmm. because I didn't want a melodramatic, maudlin tale of just, oh, woe is me. Who wants to read that, you know? And certain things, I mean, my parents were pot-smoking hippies, and we lived in the woods of Texas with just no running water or electricity or anything. You can't have a life like that and not have at least one funny story. So it helped me find where the good humorous parts were so that it just brought some levity to the book. Yeah.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line, we have Paul in Dallas. Hi, Paul.
Hi. I just have a comment. I am hearing, obviously, and I don't really know American Sign Language very well, but I'm currently dating a guy who just happens to be deaf. And as I was listening to the program, I heard Cambry talk about how there's sort of an exoticism associated with deaf culture. And I certainly kind of experienced that, and it was very interesting. But I remember on our first date, I was shocked that at the end of our date, which was a lot of just like rudimentary sign language and like typing, that there was sort of an intimacy of trying to earnestly communicate with somebody in a different medium that was really interesting. And even though I exchanged a fraction of the words that I would have normally exchanged in a hearing with a hearing person in the same amount of time, I felt like we knew each other better than, because what we were trying to say, we really, really wanted to say.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things my husband, when he first met me, he said, she cannot possibly be this into me, because I was always touching him and really fully engaged. And that's the difference between speaking to someone on the phone and over the internet and everything. But even in person, across from a hearing person, it's different. When you're speaking with a deaf person, there's a lot of touching and pushing and pulling and hugging. And it's a very intimate language. It is, because you have to be so fully engaged and really focused on somebody's face and what they're trying to convey. My father, after he and my mother divorced, he never dated another deaf woman again. He had dated one briefly, and then he has only had hearing girlfriends since then, and they would all learn sign language to be with him. He's that charismatic.
Author Cambry Cruz is my guest. Her new book is called Burn Down the Ground, a Memoir. If you'd like to join us, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Cambry Cruz, author of the new memoir, Burn Down the Ground. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. So when the family moved to North Richland Hills, you were for the first time in a school large enough to have really serious cliques. Talk about how you decided to distinguish yourself.
My first thing that I did was got a job. I had been working since I was 13 years old in Montgomery as a busboy and on the side of the road in a fireworks stand. And I knew that image was everything in high school. Mm-hmm. And so I was determined that I was not going to stand out for the wrong reasons. And so I got a job at Showbiz Pizza Place, which is now Chuck E. Cheese, over on Grapevine Highway in North Richland Hills. And I used the money to buy new clothes and name brand clothes. I'd never had name brand clothes before. And I scraped and saved and made sure that I looked the right part, like I looked the part. And then the other thing was to become immersed in the theater department. In Montgomery, it was just such a small school. We didn't really have anything like that. They had a couple of smaller things, but nothing to the scale that Richland High School did, the one-act play competition being the biggest in the UIL system. And that really honestly saved me from going down the wrong path. I was headed down the wrong path for sure, and theater arts saved me.
And your brother really struggled at this time in your lives.
Oh, absolutely. He had started smoking marijuana at a very young age, and that just gradually went on to harder drugs. And by the time we moved up to North Richland Hills, he was completely addicted, and he struggled with addiction and dropped out of school, and he never worked. So he was quite the polar opposite of me. But he had, I think it was a difference between being a boy and a girl in a household. Like, my father treated my brother more like his sidekick,
yeah,
like his wingman. Yeah. And I think that exposed my brother. And that's just speculation on my point, but I think that's probably part of it. Boys are just treated differently.
Well, there's one point where you describe that your father had been gone for several days, and you write something like, I think he and David were hanging out, which seems strange with an 18-year-old, you know, mm-hmm. son and a whatever it was, 40-year-old father.
Yeah. Oh, no, they went to bars all the time and like the deaf clubs and stuff. And that was my 16th birthday. That's when they yeah. were hanging out and everybody forgot my birthday.
Hmm. I mean, it was funny as I was reading it. That was around the time the movie 16 Candles came mm-hmm. out. Did you not find that movie funny at all?
Oh, I loved that movie.
Because you could relate.
It never even made the correlation to me.
Really?
just how could they? Well, my mom technically didn't forget. She scheduled surgery for the day mm-hmm. of my birthday. So that was, I can kind of let her off the hook a little bit, but not too much. She scheduled it. But yeah, I just don't even understand how my own father forgot it. Oh, I was so mad.
The other thing, you know, you don't write about yourself ever in a self-congratulatory way, and yet we really come to like you as you are, particularly as a young child. You had this obsession with running your own library.
Part of that was because of the boredom and isolation in the woods. This is prior to moving up to Fort Worth, and mm-hmm. it made me look around and see what could I do to entertain myself. And I created papier-mâché puppets and wrote and directed a puppet show for the neighbors. I charged admission and popped popcorn and stuff, things like that you could do in the city, but there was nobody to come and attend my shows. So my mom had subscribed me to a Book of the Month Club, mm-hmm. Doubleday Book Club, and I amassed a huge collection, as did my mother. And so I decided that I would run my own library, my own public library, and I had people fill out a form, and I would give them a card, and I did the Dewey Decimal System tabs on the spines of every book. It was a long, elaborate project that lasted a few years before I kind of got, you know, entered my teenage years and thought it was a little too corny.
And your dad, I take it, built you these specialized bookcases and everything. I think one of the other great tragedies of his life, as you describe it here, is that he is not someone who doesn't have a great deal of talent.
Oh, he's extraordinarily talented. If you saw some of his handiwork, you would be amazed. It looks like it only somebody in a factory could do it, and he would do it just in the backyard or in the shed with his own bare hands. He's amazing. And he's extraordinarily smart as well. He's got a very high IQ, and his construction skills were unparalleled. And this was in the days of the construction boom in Houston, during the oil boom, I should say. And so he served actually as foreman on many projects, which a deaf man in this authority role was pretty amazing for the late 70s.
Why do you think your parents stayed together as long as they did?
Well, you know, and we haven't really talked too much about the domestic abuse mm-hmm. that my mom was going through, because I, as a child, didn't really know about it either. But it's not an atypical behavior on the part of a victim to stay with the abuser. Look at Chris Brown and Rihanna. I mean, she's yeah. gone back to him, and she's a very wealthy, self-made woman. There's no reason she should go back to him. But the thing about an abuser is they don't abuse you every day, usually. And the days they're not abusing you, they're really amazing. They're very yeah. charismatic. They're very apologetic, and they shower you with love. My father was very, very loving, extremely talented. He provided well for us for a time. And she's also as isolated as he was and as I was, so was she. Where was she going to go? And she's a deaf woman. And so the resources for a deaf woman in an abusive relationship aren't just as handy as they are for someone else, and immigrant families have the same issue. And this is the days before the Violence Against Women Act, which wasn't enacted until 1994, so that there weren't safeguards in place.
Yeah, I hadn't realized that it took that long to have protection. But at one point, the police were called after your parents had split up, but before they were legally divorced, and they really couldn't do anything for your mother.
It's astounding that that is how it was treated. But yeah, my father had come over and terrorized us and physically abused my mother, punched holes in our walls. It was a very traumatic event for me. I was just a teenager. I hadn't even entered my senior year in high school. And I called the police, and they asked what the status of my parents' relationship was. Now, technically, they hadn't, as you mentioned, they were separated. They hadn't gotten a divorce. But we were living in an apartment, and my father's name wasn't even on the lease because my mom had tried to sneak away and escape from him and get her own apartment, and she wasn't going to tell him where we moved. He found out where she lived and then kind of forced his way back into the apartment to live with us. So because he had been living with us in this apartment and so therefore had clothes in the closet and some personal effects in the bathroom, and they were technically still legally married, that meant he had a right to be there, even though his name wasn't on the lease, even though he was not supposed to be there. He didn't have keys to the apartment. And that is something I don't think would happen today, now that the VAWA, V-A-W-A, the Violence Against Women Act, has been enacted. I don't think that would happen today. I hope not.
It's really moving in the book when, you know, as you begin as an adult to fully understand the nature of the relationship between your parents, it occurred to you that they had been fighting all along, but because they signed to one another, they could close their bedroom door and you'd have no idea.
Yeah. Now, deaf people can be very vocal during arguments, but my mother took great pains to keep that away from us. And so she would, their bedroom was on the opposite end of our trailer, and she would go into their bathroom, which was inside their bedroom, so as far away from us as possible. And she protected us from seeing this really dark, angry side of my father. And he didn't really shout. He didn't use his voice much.
You got married very young the first time. Were you just looking to get away? What do you think you were searching for?
Oh, absolutely. It was an escape. I was a very good student, and I had college goals and dreams. And there's no reason I shouldn't have gone to college. I was 4.0, summa cum laude graduate. But this event, this attack on my mother that my father committed, it changed my life. I'd never seen my father act this way before. And it turned my life upside down. And my mom and my family and the way I was raised, I was never really taught how to ask for help. My mother had always prided herself in the fact that we'd never taken welfare or food stamps, and this was a source of pride for her. But that also, and she also never reached out to get help for protection from my father, and therefore I never knew how to ask for help. I didn't know where to turn. I mean, honestly, I should have just walked into the high school guidance counselor's office and said I needed help, but I didn't know how. And surely they didn't know that I needed it because, like I said, I was a great student, very active in theater, 4.0. There's no reason to worry about me. And so when this event happened, I got overwhelmed with the devastation of my family. And I was at the time dating a man who was in the U.S. Navy. And the U.S. Navy actually pays you to be married. They pay you housing pay and dependent pay, and that just seemed like a meal ticket right out of there. Mm-hmm. And thankfully, my ex-husband, Rob, he was a very kind and good person, so I definitely picked a good winner.
You do write about, you told one girlfriend about what had happened. You said, well, my father tried to kill my mother this summer, and the look on her face told you, oh, it was a mistake to share this with anyone.
Yeah, it was, you know, she had met my father at these theater events. She knew him, and to put that person with the story I was telling her, that did not match up, which is actually also why it was so awful for me, because that was not the father that I had grown up with or known. My father had only spanked me once in my life, and I had a Bible stuffed in my pants, and he let me get away with it, you know. So, I had a hard time even making the match between these two sides of my dad. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, when I told her this, she just looked at me like I was telling a tall tale, that she didn't believe me, and also it made her very uncomfortable, which, you know, you're a teenager. Of course it does.
Yeah.
And so I just felt like, oh, you know what, I should probably just keep this to myself. And you want to be normal in high school, too. So it kind of made me afraid that I would be the source of a lot of gossip and stuff.
Were there things that you were forced to remember to write this book, or that you happened to remember in writing this book that you hadn't thought about in a long time?
You know, I'm really happy about how easy all my memories came back to me. I have a lot of pictures and journals that I've kept over the years, so that was helpful. And I did interview my mom a few times just to make sure I was that my memories did match up. And then, of course, whenever my father was incarcerated for 20 years and I demanded the truth, I interviewed her even more for that.
Mm-hmm.
Those were the memories that I didn't know, you know, the stories, I should say, that I didn't even know that my mom had kept from me. But I was really happy with how much I remembered. It came a lot easier than I think it does for other people.
How did you decide to tell the story publicly? I mean, were there friends who, as an adult, knew your story and said, you really have to do something with it?
Well, it's my husband. You know, my husband's a comedian.
Mm-hmm.
And being in the comedy business, comedians are constantly mining their lives, trolling for something, anything that they can use to make a joke.
And often the worst stuff in their lives.
Oh, yeah. And, of course, all comedians, or not all, but that's kind of a cliche or stereotype that comedians have these really dark sides to them. Mm-hmm. And it is true for many. So my husband just thought it was delightful when we were at parties to tell people about my story, because he loved watching the expressions on their faces change. Like, this couldn't be how this girl was raised.
Mm-hmm.
And as the facts unveiled themselves and they were crazier and crazier and crazier, they were like, oh my gosh, you got to tell this. You got to write a book. And so it was really the encouragement of the comedy community and the people I worked with that they just kept pushing and pushing and pushing.
It's funny to think that people might not meet you for the first time and think that you were part of the deaf community, and they also might not meet you for the first time and think that you had had a traumatic childhood.
Yeah, they, you know, I'm here in New York, and I don't have, like, any mental issues that that they can see. I seem relatively normal. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've done well for myself, and it's not an easy city to do well in. And so I think people they think that, oh, she must have had an Ivy League education and lived on Fifth Avenue. That's hardly the case.
In the last few seconds, is your mom doing okay these days?
Oh, she's great. She just retired.
Hmm.
So, yeah, it's kind of a weird it gave me a weird, sad feeling to see her retire. She's worked so hard in her whole life, and she's one of the hardest working women that I know. So it was hard to see this. I guess it's just a transition in life, and
yeah,
kind of made me sad, but she's doing really well.
The new memoir by author Cambry Cruz is called Burn Down the Ground. Cambry, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you, Chris. This has been fantastic. Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.